Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Morbidology. Before we get started, I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporters, Michelle Pierce, Natalie, Hannah Jasinski, Ryan Hellquist, and Nicole Bartosz. I am eternally grateful for your support. You can support the show on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. There's some cool extras up on there, like exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on Morbidology. The support on Patreon goes such a long way in helping this one woman podcast continue to grow. I have a quick word from my sponsors, and then on with the show. Real Paper are creating bamboo toilet paper that not only does good, but feels good as well. I'm lucky enough that they've sponsored this episode of Morbidology. Every single day, 2.4 billion people are forced to defecate outside, meaning lost dignity, exposure to deadly pathogens, increased risk of contaminated water, and even loss of life. That's why Real Paper are on a mission to provide much-needed access to clean toilets to those without. By purchasing a roll of Real Paper, not only are you getting an amazing product and reducing your carbon footprint, but you're also supporting their mission in helping those in need. Real Paper is made from 100% bamboo, is plastic-free, and is delivered right to your doorstep. They have partnered with Soil, a non-profit research and development organization working in Haiti, to provide sustainable and cost-effective solutions to the sanitation crisis. They donate a portion of each sale and give back 100% of any direct donations on Soil's behalf. So click the link in my show notes or head to realpaper.com, that is reelpaper.com, and enter Morbidology for 25% off your order. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. It was around midnight on the 8th of October 2016 when a number of drivers swerved to miss a man driving the wrong way on the I-89 highway in Vermont. Emergency dispatchers received phone call after phone call about a vehicle speeding north in a southbound lane. They desperately scrambled to reach and locate the vehicle, but soon enough, reports of a crash came flooding in.
Hi, I'm on Interstate 89 heading south, exit 11. I just passed the car going the wrong way on the wrong side of the highway.
He was flying. Northbound on the southbound side?
Correct. Just passed exit 11. He's heading up the hill. I mean, he was flying.
I believe we're
already getting called on,
okay? So we'll
okay. Okay.
Please,
okay. Then what?
What does the vehicle look like?
I think it looked like a Chevy Blazer, maybe. I don't know. He's going to the back, and the headlights flying together. I was trying to get the hell out of his way.
When a Williston officer arrived at the scene, he found a vehicle up in flames with five people trapped inside. He grabbed a fire extinguisher and managed to pull a female out of the vehicle. As he desperately attempted to put the fire out and rescue the people trapped inside, a man stole his patrol vehicle and fled away. Next, you will be able to hear the responding officer shouting over the radio that somebody had stolen his patrol vehicle. By this point, more officers had arrived at the scene. A Richmond officer attempted to intercept and stop the man from speeding away, but the man managed to quickly turn the vehicle and began heading north on the southbound lane, back towards the crash site. A number of passerby had stopped to try and offer assistance and put out the flames. Paul Swan had been driving home from work when he pulled over to try and help. Speaking with WCAX-TV, he said that there was debris all across the road and he could hear people screaming and yelling. Moments later, he saw the man steal the patrol vehicle and veer up the wrong side of the road, heading straight towards them. The man in the patrol vehicle slammed into the burning car a second time, as well as several other vehicles.
Wish I had some way that I could help somebody, because standing there, seeing a car full of people go up in flames, it doesn't feel good to feel helpless.
As the man crashed into several other vehicles, one collision had been with such force that the man had been thrown from the patrol vehicle, which burst into flames. The man was arrested at the scene and was identified as 36-year-old Stephen Burgoyne. He was taken to the University of Vermont Medical Center. The first crash that the officers had responded to was extremely severe. The car had burst into flames and had trapped 5 occupants inside the car. Sadly, they all perished in the crash. The 5 people in the car were identified as 16-year-old Mary Harris of Moortown, 16-year-old Cyrus Satchu of Moortown, 16-year-old William Hale of Faison, 15-year-old Janie Causey of Faison, and 16-year-old Eli Brookins of Waterbury. The group of teenagers had been lifelong friends and had been returning home from a concert in Burlington. Several other people had been injured in the crash, but thankfully, none of their injuries were life-threatening. 4 of the teenagers were students at Harwood Union School, while Janie attended Kimball Union Academy. After their identifications, Principal Amy Rex of Harwood Union School released a statement which read, "This is an unprecedented tragedy. We have suffered a tremendous loss. These students were vibrant members of our school community, actively involved, and all with a promise for a bright future." There had been a bank holiday on Monday, but the school announced that they would be open for anybody that wanted to meet with the crisis team. School officials got in contact with Washington County Mental Health Services and the Northeastern Family Institute to help provide support for students who may wish to speak through their feelings and thoughts about what had happened. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin ordered flags to be flown half-staff in honour of the 5 students. In a statement, he described that the loss in such a senseless tragedy is heartbreaking. As news of the crash swept through the city, details of the suspect's past were made public. At the time of the crash, Stephen had been facing a domestic assault charge. In May of the same year, Stephen had hit his girlfriend, Anila Lawrence, in the head and threatened to throw her down the stairs. According to the arrest report, when Anila tried to leave Stephen with their 2-year-old child, Stephen got into the vehicle and started to shout that he wanted to keep their child. He pushed Anila and climbed into the driver's seat. He hit her in the head and began pulling on the lanyard that was around her neck. Anila had said, "He whipped out of the driveway and wouldn't let us out. While going down the road, he grabbed my neck lanyard again and we almost went off the road. He sped out towards Essex and was yelling about how he'd kill us both before he'd let the child go with me." Stephen had threatened Anila by saying that he was going to drive to a place where there was no cell phone reception and that the police would not be able to respond. She said that he drove her on for a while before eventually calming down and driving them back home. When he got into the shower back at home, Anila left with their child and went straight to the Williston police station. She informed police that a very similar incident had happened 2 years prior when the couple were living in Massachusetts. In the police report, Anila said that she suffered from headaches from all of the times that Stephen had pulled her by the hair. After the attack on Anila, Stephen was released on conditions that he had no contact with her. Anila was granted full custody of their daughter. According to Anila, Stephen was often angry and had severe mood swings. She said that their relationship had changed after the birth of their daughter in February of 2015. Anila had told police, "When Stephen gets in his moods, he does not think clearly and has no regard for those around him, even loved ones. When Stephen is in these moods, it is usually because he ran out of marijuana, which he used to stabilize his mood swings. It was always very evident when he was out of marijuana, as he would be more angry and violent during those times." Stephen had prior convictions of driving under the influence and domestic assault. At the time of the crash, Stephen had been scheduled to appear in court on the 4th of November for a child support hearing and had been scheduled to go on trial for the domestic assault charge on the 7th of November. As Stephen remained hospitalized, investigators were still trying to figure out the motive for the senseless attack. It was evident by Stephen's behavior that this hadn't been an accident. During a press briefing, Chittenden County Prosecutor T.J. Donovan was asked if he believed that Stephen had been attempting to end his own life. He replied that he would not be classifying what happened on Interstate 89 as an accident, but elaborated no further. On Monday, a candlelit vigil was held in memory of all five students at the Harwood Union High School soccer field. Over 1,000 pupils, teachers, and parents huddled together to light heart-shaped sky lanterns, which they then released into the sky. The vigil had been planned by Patrick McHugh, whose daughter was friends with the victims. During the vigil, he stated, "I think it's with a collective broken heart that we're all here tonight." A number of family members of the victims took part in the vigil, and Mary's uncle, Daryl Mays, encouraged people not to dwell on their anger. He stated, "Obviously, this person has had one hell of a troubled life. Vengeance does no good. Anger will only lead to violence. Think of these families, these children, our communities, and let's be bigger than the bad guys." He additionally urged the young people in attendance to live their lives well, to honour those who had died, and to be thankful for their friends. Classes resumed on the Tuesday, but the sombre day was anything but normal. The halls were eerily quiet. Throughout the day, students wrote notes to their classmates who were killed in the crash and placed those letters on tables alongside flowers, photographs, a signed soccer ball, and athletic jerseys. All of the victims had been massive soccer fans and played on the teams at school. Pupils and teachers throughout Addison County wore black and gold, which were the school colours of Harwood Union High School. They sent flowers, food, and notes of support from the other students. Speaking of the students, Superintendent Bridget Sheffer-Niece said that the tragedy had brought them all together, not just the students, but the entire state. She said, "I mean, we are just hearing from everyone. Everyone is offering support and wanting to do something, hence the flowers and the food. I think it's comforting." The school had also set up a special room for any students who needed a quiet place to try and cope with the tragedy, speak about the tragedy, console with friends, or speak to counselors. Just the following day, court documents were released which showed that Stephen had sought medical help less than 24 hours before the crash. Security footage showed him entering and exiting the hospital's emergency room three times between 8:45 a.m. and 11:05 a.m. According to a statement from the hospital, Stephen had been seen by a physician assistant who referred him to the HARD Centre. The HARD Centre provides crisis and counselling services and holds a roughly $90 million state contract to provide mental health services. However, as it turned out, Stephen was never screened there. Following the affidavit release, it was announced that Stephen had been charged with five counts of second-degree murder, and his bail was set for $1 million. His condition in the hospital had been upgraded from critical to good, and he was ordered to be arraigned several days later. Stephen was wheeled to a conference room at the University of Vermont Medical Center, where he pleaded not guilty to the five murders. During the hearing, Prosecutor Donovan said that Stephen had displayed a wanton disregard for human life as he drove around 5 miles the wrong way. He said that he had been driving around 79 miles per hour when he hit the teenager's car, and then 107 miles per hour when he hit it a second time and hit the other vehicles with the patrol vehicle that he had stolen. It was additionally revealed that at the first scene, Stephen had told a witness that he must have lost control and he wasn't sure what had happened. Investigators were still waiting for the results of the toxicology tests. According to court documents, Stephen had been facing foreclosure and had received a shut-off notice from the gas company, as well as facing a domestic abuse charge and a custody dispute. The judge ordered a competency hearing. In the wake of the crash, questions were raised in regards to how healthcare providers screen people who seek out help. As mentioned, Stephen had gone into the emergency room three times, and a nurse contacted HARD Centre but did not screen him. HARD Centre said that they were cooperating with the investigation. However, an affidavit was filed and it cast question on whether or not HARD Centre had actually been contacted. State Attorney Donovan released a statement and said that they were trying to get clarity on the issue and said that they would update the case when possible. According to Frank Reed, the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Mental Health, policies and procedures in regards to mental health carried from hospital to hospital across the state. If someone went to hospital and were deemed to be an immediate threat to themselves or to others, screening could trigger a court process for involuntary hospitalization, but seemingly this didn't happen with Stephen. However, if the issue isn't considered serious, it could result in a referral for a screening. It is up to the medical provider to determine what steps are taken next. According to Jack McCulloch, director of Vermont Legal Aid's Mental Health Law Project, one of the biggest issues within Vermont's mental health treatment system was the lack of resources at community level. He said that a shortage of services meant that numerous people with mental health issues had difficulty finding support until their case is considered a serious level, and at that point, they are hospitalized. Shortly thereafter, the HARD Centre confirmed that they had never been contacted to evaluate Stephen. They said that Stephen was not a client and that no organization had sent them a referral on his behalf. The investigation into the case was still underway, and one angle was trying to uncover what had happened when Stephen went into the emergency room. One of Stephen's best friends spoke with the media and said that Stephen had suffered from anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder, which had stemmed from childhood trauma. They said that Stephen may also have Lyme disease. According to Asima Swabik, she had known Stephen for the past 8 years, and when she heard that he was responsible for the deadly crash, she didn't initially believe it. She wouldn't elaborate any further on what the childhood trauma entailed, but said that Stephen had spoken with her about it in the past. She said that Stephen was a regular guy who had depended heavily on his friends because he had no family. She said that Stephen had grown up without a mother, and his father and grandmother had died a few years earlier in quick succession. Asima divulged that Stephen had a lot of problems and his mood had darkened over the past several months. However, she said that she and her husband had never once heard Stephen say or do anything suicidal, and outside of the domestic assault charge, she was not aware of any violent behaviour. According to one of the first officers who had arrived on the scene, he had known Stephen from a previous domestic assault charge and said that Stephen had suffered from PTSD. Stephen had worked at Lake Champagne Chocolates, but just the day before the crash, he quit his job. He told his manager that he was sick and he needed a job that paid more money. When it was discovered that the Howard Centre had not been contacted, speculation was rife that Stephen had slipped through the cracks of Vermont's mental health care system. On the 21st of October, Stephen left hospital and was moved to a state prison in Springfield. Meanwhile, Harwood Union High School was planning a celebration of life for the five victims who perished in the crash, which would be held on the Monday. There would be student and faculty speakers, music, and a slideshow. A special community fund had also been established for all of the victims. Pupils, teachers, and parents all packed in to Harwood Union High School for the event. People spoke fondly about the friends that they had lost. Zinn Wolf spoke about how he and Eli had become friends in the fourth grade. He reminisced about how they would spend almost every weekend together on the mountain. They had learned to ski in an after-school program. He recollected fondly of the time they went to ski down a closed trail because the snow was perfect. He said that when they got to the bottom, there were three ski patrol members waiting for them. Their parents were called and their ski passes were taken away from them, but later that night, their parents handed them back. He laughed while telling the crowd that they both thought that they were badasses for pulling it off. He described Eli as having an incredible work ethic. Anna Jarecki spoke about Janie. She said that they were the best of friends, especially before Janie moved to Kimball Union Academy. She relayed how she spent most of her days with Janie. In the morning on the weekend, Janie's mother would drop Janie off at Anna's home because she worked at the weekends. Janie would let herself in and just climb into bed next to Anna and fall asleep. She described Janie as the kind of friend she went to for advice. She said, "I know she'd be telling all of us here to keep her in our hearts and minds and to move forward. She'd hate to see us go through our days sad and broken because she's not here." Anna Fortier said that she was lucky that she got to spend so much time with Liam. She described how she had known Liam for most of her life and that they both shared a passion for fashion and cars. Anna loved horses and Liam loved riding bikes. She fondly recalled that he often laughed about the fact that they both liked sit-down sports because who wants to stand for that long? She said that Liam always had a way to make people laugh. He was the joker of the group and always had something funny to do or something funny to say, making everybody erupt in laughter. Lauren Green had been at the same concert as the victims that night. Lauren was best friends with Mary. She had known her since preschool and they often joked that they were twins. She was the friend she always went to for advice, the sister she never had. At the service, she said that the five teenagers could not have had a better night and she felt lucky that she got to attend the concert with them. She described how they spent the night dancing and singing. She went on to say that she could have spoken about how amazing Mary was for hours on end, but said that everybody in attendance probably already knew that. She described Mary as friendly, sweet, and extremely outgoing. Mourners also heard from Eli Hammond, who remembered Cyrus as one of his best friends. He described how Cyrus's death had left a hole in his heart, and he was upset that he never got to say goodbye. He went on to say that he felt extremely lucky to have had Cyrus as such a good friend. He reminisced about how when they were much younger, they went to Martha's Vineyard and felt like they were on top of the world. He said, "It was in these moments that I knew I had a best friend for life." The memorial service ended with a firework display to commemorate the stolen lives of the teenagers. By this point, 20 investigators were working on the case. They had heard from around 60 witnesses and were attempting to recreate the crash as well as the timeline leading up to it. they were continuing to assess things such as terrain and the condition of the other cars involved. They also needed to look at the role speed played in the crash. Court documents were released which showed that the first officer on the scene had speculated that Stephen may have been under the influence of alcohol and drugs. According to Trooper Bradley Miller, Stephen was extremely disorientated at the crash scene and was unable to inform the trooper of his name. However, Prosecutor Donovan had said that police had no evidence that Stephen was under the influence at the time. He said that the toxicology report had come back, but they were not publicly releasing its findings yet. However, just the following day, some of the findings of the toxicology report were released. It was revealed that the toxicology report indicated strong evidence of marijuana in Stephen's system at the time of the crash. However, it was announced that the full toxicology report would be kept secret for now. Afterwards, it was announced that Stephen had been scheduled for an evaluation of his mental fitness to stand trial. His defense attorney, Robert Cadams, had requested the competency evaluation but had not stated whether or not he would raise competency or insanity as a defense. The evaluation was scheduled for the 1st of December at Southern State Correctional Facility. The evaluation would determine that Stephen was competent to stand trial. Stephen was next in court for a hearing about whether his daughter and her mother, Anila, would be able to visit him in prison. He had been ordered to have no contact with Anila after the domestic assault charge, but according to attorney Cadams, Anila had agreed to vacate a relief from abuse order so that their daughter could visit him with herself present. Prosecutors opposed the request because Anila may be a witness in the upcoming murder trial. According to Deputy State's Attorney Amy Griffin, any openings for tainting of evidence or any discussion of the case is completely inappropriate in the state's eyes. Later that month, it was announced that Stephen had withdrawn his request to allow his daughter to visit him in prison. Instead, however, his lawyers said that an agreement had been reached with the prosecution wherein Stephen could have contact over the phone with his daughter and Anila. Under these revised conditions, Stephen was forbidden from speaking about any facts regarding the crash or the domestic assault charge. Moreover, prosecutors would be able to obtain copies of phone conversations which would be recorded by the Vermont Corrections Department. In October, it was the 1-year anniversary to the crash. The community had truly kept the teenagers alive in memory, and now they wanted something permanent to commemorate the lost lives. Students and teachers at Harwood Union High School put up a gazebo and dedicated it to Mary, Cyrus, Liam, Eli, and Janie. At the dedication ceremony, school board chair David Goodman said, "Celebrating life is what this gazebo is all about. It's a gathering place, a spot to hang out, to make music, to laugh and cry, to be together. Out of something sad, we've made something beautiful. I can't think of a better way for the class of 2018 to honour the spirit of these 5 amazing friends, now and for future generations." The school truly was an inspiration in how a school should deal with such a tragedy. While a year had passed, the school still continued their healing process. Resources were still available for students and staff in the form of counsellors and therapy dogs. Additionally, they still had forms for parents and wellness activities. It was hoped that the case would be ready to go to trial in February of 2018. However, shortly after the 1-year anniversary, it was announced that it would be closer to spring. Defence Cadams appeared in court where he said that there were potentially 50 depositions of police officers that still needed to be taken, and there were over 100 potential witnesses. The toxicology report had still not been made public, but it was stated that Stephen had 10 nanograms of THC in his blood system 8 hours after the crash. This was twice the legal driving limit in Colorado, where recreational marijuana is legal. This only added fuel to the already ongoing debate over whether marijuana should be legalized in Vermont. According to Representative Ben Joseph, a former Superior Court judge, legalization would expand ready access to marijuana, which he said would increase highway crashes. Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman strongly disagreed. He stated that Stephen had a number of other issues, including opioid fentanyl and benzodiazepine, an anti-anxiety prescription drug, in his system at the time of the crash and had sought mental health help. Governor Zuckerman said, "There's scant evidence to show that cannabis consumption alone leads to increased crash problems." The marijuana bill was signed into law in Vermont in January of 2018, which meant that in July of that year, Vermonters would be allowed to possess and grow marijuana for recreational purposes. In March, it was announced that Stephen's defense team were planning an insanity defense. His lawyer filed court documents indicating that Stephen would be pleading not guilty by reason of insanity. Shortly after the not guilty plea was entered, Stephen's attorneys filed documents requesting that the trial be moved. They stated that pre-trial publicity would make a fair trial impossible. According to Attorney Kadams, the media coverage had been widespread and continuous, and it had created a bias against Stephen. The judge said that he needed to see actual evidence of prejudice before he could decide whether the trial should be moved. He gave the defense more time to prove what they were arguing and delayed the case until the 11th of June. Ultimately, he would decide that the trial should not be moved. He stated, "Chittenden County offers that largest pool of jurors from which a panel can be selected in the state. Given the statewide nature of the news coverage alleged by the defendant to be prejudicial, this fact further supports the court finding that a change of venue is unwarranted." Since you're listening to Morbidology, I don't doubt that you're a murder mystery fan. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing mobile puzzle game, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. Even better, this game is set in the 1920s and has a real glamorous aesthetic and a diverse cast of characters. Each scene in the game will take you through a murder mystery, but along the way, you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets. What I really love about this game is that it's super therapeutic and even relaxing, but at the same time, it truly tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I especially like to play this game late at night before I go to bed. So go ahead and download June's Journey for free at the Apple App Store or Google Play, or click the link in my show notes. The case was finally ready to head to trial in May of 2019. Family members and friends of the victims packed into the courtroom in Burlington. Stephen was led into the courtroom where he quietly sat at the defense table and made little eye contact with the jury, who were there to decide his fate. During opening statements, defense attorney Robert Kadams told the jury that Stephen was psychotic and delusional at the time of the crash and therefore legally insane. He acknowledged that Stephen was driving the car that caused the crash, but said that he was totally out of his mind at the time and that he would be presenting evidence to corroborate this claim.
This trial, however, is not about whether or not Stephen Burgoyne drove his truck the wrong way on 89 and hit the Jetta and killed him. It did. That's the hard truth. This trial is about why it happened. What was going on in Stephen Burgoyne's head on that tragic night back in October of 2016? Why in the world would he do such a thing? The evidence will be that Stephen Burgoyne was totally psychotic and delusional at the time of the crash. The evidence will be that he was, in every sense, insane at the time of the crash. All the evidence points to that conclusion. There will be testimony from two psychiatrists who will tell you that Stephen Burgoyne was suffering from a mental disease at the time of the crash that caused him to be psychotic and delusional. And due to being psychotic and delusional, the actions were done when he couldn't conform his conduct to the requirements of law or appreciate the criminality of what he's doing. That is legally insane.
He went on to claim that in the days leading up to the crash, Stephen believed he was on a secret mission, but that secret mission ended in tragedy when he slammed into the car carrying Mary, Cyrus, Liam, Eli and Janie. He told the jury that he would show that Stephen's life had been deteriorating in the lead up to the crash. Stephen hadn't been sleeping and believed that some kind of government agency had been trying to connect with him through the internet, his cell phone, and through his vehicle's radio. He claimed that after crashing into the teenager's car, he got out of his car, approached the teenager's car, and believed that what he was looking at wasn't the bodies of teenagers, but instead, mannequins with breathing apparatuses. According to attorney Cadams, his belief explained Stephen's attempt to flee from the scene in the patrol vehicle which he had stolen. Deputy Chittenden County State's Attorney Susan Hardin refuted the attorney's claims that Stephen was legally insane. She said that mental health experts had different opinions on Stephen's mental health at the time of the crash and said that while Stephen certainly was troubled, he would meet the legal definition of being sane. She painted a picture of Stephen as being in a rage over his finance problems and the child custody dispute he was going through when he purposefully crashed into the teenager's car. She said that when Stephen went to the University of Vermont Medical Center before the crash, he hadn't talked about paranoid thoughts or hallucinations, but instead, he spoke about the stress and anxiety that he had been experiencing. She stated, "The scene that night was like a war zone. People were walking around, shell-shocked."
The crash reconstructionists will tell you that at 4.8 seconds prior to the defendant crashing his truck into that Jetta, he was traveling at 79 miles per hour, no brakes being applied, and he's in the passing lane. At 2.3 seconds prior to impact, he increases his speed to 87 miles per hour, no brakes being applied, but now he's steering left into the path of travel of the Jetta. At 1.8 seconds prior to impact, he's still traveling at 87 miles per hour, no brakes being applied, still steering left. At 1.3 seconds prior to impact, he has now started to apply his brakes, and he decreases his speed to 84 miles per hour. But now he's steering right, going back towards the passing lane from which he had come. The impact between the two vehicles occurred right near the center line of I-89. At the time of impact, the defendant was going 76 miles per hour. The Jetta had slowed down to under 33 miles per hour. The force of the impact was so strong that it pushed the Jetta back up 89 and into a median where it flipped over and killed Mary Harris, 16 years old, Cyrus Zhao, 16 years old, Liam Hale, 16 years old, Janie Causey, 15 years old, and Eli Brookins, 16 years old.
Keith Porter was the first witness called for the prosecution. Keith was one of the first witnesses at the crash scene. He said that he approached Stephen, who by this point was standing outside of his vehicle. According to Kevin, Stephen stated, "I don't know what happened. I just lost control." Kevin described to the jury how after this brief conversation, he ran over to the police officer who had now arrived on scene to see if there was anything he could do to assist. Moments later, he saw Stephen steal the officer's patrol vehicle and come speeding towards him. He told the jury, "I expected not to survive. I remember hoping it would be quick." Sue Janes, a nurse practitioner who was at the crash scene, took the jury through her experience from that day.
So I got out of the car and looked at the scene. I saw the car down in the median on fire. I was really afraid to approach it. It was really on fire. So I stood for a minute. I looked to see if anyone was moving. I could see anything that looked like anyone needed help, and I didn't see anything there. So I went to the other vehicle that was across the median, which is basically right next to me. So I approached it sort of from behind and came upon the passenger side of the vehicle. I could see that the airbags had deployed. I couldn't see in to the vehicle. I remember putting my flashlight on my phone, walking around the front of the vehicle, and the driver's side door was open, and I looked in to see if there was anybody in the car, and I didn't see anyone. There was also a back seat to the car. There was no one in the back seat. But I did turn my attention, when I didn't see anyone, to the vehicle down in the median, and was standing at the top of the median looking to see if there was anything I could do. That was where I went next with my attention.
At some point, did law enforcement...
So very shortly after that was when the Williston police officer pulled up. Exactly.
And what do you remember observing what he did?
Oh, absolutely. He got out of the car and ran immediately to the vehicle. He was absolutely incredible. It was probably the most amazing bravery that I have ever witnessed. He worked really hard to get to the victims. He had a fire extinguisher. He tried to break the windows. He went to several doors, wrapping his jacket around his hand, trying to open the doors, trying to help the victims.
She drove up to the crash scene and went down the embankment where the teenager's vehicle had come to a stop. She said that she offered aid to Mary, who had been ejected from the vehicle.
So she was positioned just behind the driver's side rear tire, so very, very close to the burning vehicle, and we wanted to examine her. She was not breathing, so we knew we would probably have to do CPR, so I suggested that we move her away from the burning vehicle, which I didn't actually move her. I'm not sure which of the other three men that were there did it, but a combination of the officer, Roger, and the other person who eventually did CPR with me moved her, I want to say, not far, 10, 15 feet away.
Despite her efforts, however, she could not resuscitate Mary. Meanwhile, the doors to the vehicle, with the teenagers inside, could not be opened, and by this point, the car was up in flames. Sue said,
I did sit with Mary, and I was working on her doing CPR and felt very, very present to the fact that she was passing. I also was really, even though there was this whole emergency scene going on, I felt incredibly aware and almost a real obligation to be just super present to the fact that I didn't know who was in the vehicle next to us, but I knew that life was passing, and I feel very strongly that the passing of all life is sacred, and I felt a real obligation to just hold space because really that's all I could do. I couldn't really do anything else except to hold space for something very sacred that was happening.
Williston Police Officer Eric Shepherd was the first officer to respond to the crash site. He told the jury that he had desperately attempted to rescue the teenagers stuck in the burning vehicle. The courtroom fell silent as he said, I tried banging on the windows. I was trying to yell, get out, get out, get out. He said that the fire was far too hot and he could not get the teenagers to respond. Officer Shepherd described the moment Stephen rammed into his own vehicle. He said, as the two vehicles collided, time slowed to almost nothing. I actually watched the operator get ejected out of the driver's side window. It was something that will stick with me. That was a very bizarre thing to watch. He said that he approached Stephen, who was lying on the ground. He ordered him not to move and show him his hands, to which Stephen complied. Following his testimony, video from the dash cam of the patrol vehicle that Stephen had stolen was shown. It showed him making a U-turn, heading back north, driving again on the wrong side of the highway. Stephen then slammed the speeding patrol vehicle into vehicles that were pulled over to offer aid at the first crash site. He additionally crashed into his own damaged Toyota. Willistown Police Sergeant Brian Claffey testified about the crash. He said, "I had never seen anything like that before, not even close. So that was pretty jarring." Michael Sorensen, who had recently retired from the Vermont State Police, testified that he had reconstructed the crash as part of the investigation. He said that evidence showed that moments before the crash, the teenagers had slowed down. According to Sorensen, this indicated that they saw something that they were concerned about, and it caused them to slow down. Sergeant Owen Ballinger next took to the stand to take jurors through photographs of Stephen's smashed-up car, as well as the charred remains of the teenager's car. He detailed his examination of the wreckage and stated that the crash was an offset head-on crash, meaning that it wasn't entirely straight on. He said that the vehicles rotated and then separated, with the teenager's vehicle rolling over and landing on its wheels. Sergeant Ballinger also testified that he found no evidence of skid marks, which proved that Stephen did not try to brake. Dr. Elizabeth Bundock, the state's deputy chief medical examiner, testified that Mary was identified at the scene, while the others had to be identified by dental records. Mary was the only one to be ejected from the vehicle. She described how all of the teenagers had sustained blunt force trauma injuries, and their manner of death was homicide. Following all of the state's witnesses, it was now the defense's turn to present their own evidence. However, Attorney Cadams asked the judge to enter a judgment of acquittal for his client, stating that the state's case did not present any evidence to explain Stephen's actions in the crash. He argued that it would take speculation for the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Stephen's actions would constitute a second-degree murder. Judge Kevin Griffin denied the motion, and the case proceeded. Stephen's ex-girlfriend and the mother of his daughter was the next to testify. She told the jury that he had severe mood swings and told them the story of the time he drove around with her and her daughter in the car, threatening them.
Was there an incident in May of 2016 where Mr. Burgoyne assaulted you?
Yes.
And what was going on between you and Mr. Burgoyne prior to that? Do you remember?
Angry when I got home from work.
I'm sorry, he was angry when you got home from work?
Yes.
What was he angry about?
Financial stuff.
Did he accuse you of anything?
I don't remember.
And so, after this argument, what did you do?
He told me to leave. Take our daughter.
So what did you do?
I took my daughter to put her in her car seat.
And what happened?
He came outside and started trying to pull us out of the car, and I had my work lanyard on, and pulling that, and because of the type of car I have, the key doesn't have to be in anything. There's nowhere to put the key. Just push start. He was able to take the car with me in the back seat and my daughter.
And what happened?
I couldn't even buckle her in her car seat. I was screaming and upset about custody stuff and just kept driving, and I don't even remember how long it was. And towards the end, threatened to drive us into a pond.
She quoted Stephen as saying, "We can all just die in the pond." She said that Stephen had been driving erratically and he only stopped when she agreed to 50-50 custody of their daughter. She described how his behaviour was a stark difference to how he behaved when they started their relationship. Between 2008 and 2013, Stephen behaved normally. they had purchased a condo together and frequently went on vacation.
And you describe him as happy during this period. Do you ever see a change in Mr. Burgoyne?
After that, yeah, got a little tricky with being with the pregnancy, and not that it was a hard pregnancy, just work and such, and tight finances.
Okay, and what was the change you saw in Mr. Burgoyne?
Would just get really frustrated about all the finances and stuff and get angry about it.
She said that after the birth of their daughter, things went downhill because of family, work, and tight finances. They had talked about getting married and about having two weddings, one of which would be in Massachusetts, where Stephen's grandmother lived, and the other in Vermont. She detailed how the wedding in Vermont was planned for the Ponds in Bolton Valley, but one day Stephen randomly stated that he didn't want anybody to attend the wedding. Later that night, he called around the guests, including the bridesmaids and the ushers, and told them that they weren't invited. Stephen became depressed, she said, and would stay up late at night, talking on the phone or looking on the internet. She said that he developed intense mood swings and would become much angrier about money issues and shut off notices from utilities. She said that he often smoked marijuana, but had stopped drinking alcohol.
Did you notice any change in Mr. Burgoyne after he stopped drinking?
No, he was pretty proud of himself for stopping. As of that time, it wasn't... I mean, through the summer, it was okay. And towards the fall, I noticed more of the mood swings.
Okay. And what did you notice about the mood swings?
Just getting angry at little things that... Just mostly the money stuff or bills or shut-off notices and... such.
And when you say mood swings, would it swing back then? In other words, he would be angry and upset, and then what would happen after he was angry and upset?
Usually calm down.
And would you be able to have a discussion with him about how he was when he was angry and upset?
Didn't generally do that, no.
Did he seem to have a memory of being angry and upset?
Yes.
Always?
Most of the time, yeah.
At one point, their doctor had suggested that Stephen begin taking antidepressants, but Stephen didn't want to.
At the time, he just didn't want to take any prescription medication like that.
Do you know why?
He's lost friends and stuff to drug overdoses and such, and did not want to ever be addicted to anything like that.
Under cross-examination by the prosecution, Stephen's ex-girlfriend, Anila, admitted that Stephen had never spoken to her about being on some kind of mission or about any delusions that he was having. Following her testimony, Shannon Roberto, one of the first responders on the scene, was called to testify. She spoke about Stephen's demeanor at the crash site.
The patient was in and out of responsiveness, so... It varied throughout the call. When he would be awake and talking, he was asking random phrases, like, where am I, where are we going, or take me to the hospital, things like that. So he seemed confused, but he was able to speak in phrases.
She described how Stephen appeared to be in and out of responsiveness and that he was confused and disoriented. She went on to recall that Stephen asked her where he was and where he was going. Following her testimony, Alan Sozabek was called to the stand. Alan was a former co-worker and neighbour of Stephen. He said that he had allowed Stephen to live with his family when Anila was living with her family in Colchester. He told the jury that they had spoken about Stephen's financial troubles as well as his job issues. He said that quite frequently, Stephen would pace around the house, and at one point, he made a false claim that Alan had been speaking about him behind his back. He reminisced back to the day of the crash and said that around 4 a.m, Stephen had come to his house and asked if Anila was there. She wasn't, but Alan invited Stephen in, and once again, they spoke about his finance issues. This testimony was followed by Dr. David Rosmarin, who testified that he believed that Stephen was legally insane at the time of the crash. He said He did not intend to go the wrong direction and kill people or kill himself. He had been doing the same thing he had been doing for 2 days, which was driving around frantically, trying to preserve his life, trying to understand what he had to do next to be safe. He stated that after the first crash, Stephen got out of the car, opened the door of the other vehicle, and saw what he believed were mannequins on fire. Under cross-examination, however, State Attorney George said that Stephen attempted to get away from police by stealing a patrol vehicle and that he remembered the crash as well as before and after it. She reminded Dr. Rosmarin that Stephen had said that he remembered driving in to oncoming traffic and thought he should turn around, but decided not to. According to Dr. Rosmarin, he believed that Stephen was suffering from bipolar disorder.
He had bipolar disorder with psychotic features, rapid cycling, meaning a certain number of episodes per year.
He told the jury that Stephen believed that the television had been sending him Morse code messages through the television and the internet. He additionally allegedly believed that his car radio was directing him through the rhythm of the music. Dr. Rosmarin stated that when Stephen went to the University of Vermont Medical Center, he had been seeking somewhere safe to hide from the government because he now believed that the government were turning on him. According to the doctor who had seen Stephen at the hospital, he had stated that he was stressed about his job and family problems, but said that he was not suicidal or homicidal. She said that there was no indication that Stephen was delusional. When Dr. Rosmarin was being further cross-examined, he was asked whether Stephen may have been exaggerating or faking his symptoms. State Attorney George questioned him in regards to inconsistencies in parts of Stephen's recounting of the events that led up to the crash. Dr. Rosmarin rejected the theory that Stephen's actions that night may have been an attempt to kill himself, and once again said that he was doing everything he could to preserve his life.
He did not intend to go the wrong direction and kill people or kill himself. He did not intend that. He was doing the same thing he had been doing for 2 days, which is driving around frantically, trying to preserve his life, trying to understand what he had to do next to be safe. The last day was primarily about his safety. Were they going to kill him? Were they going to kill Izzy? Were they going to burn down his house? He was trying to be safe, and he was in such a state of psychotic frenzy and confusion, and listening to the directions, his inferences from the radio and lights in the environment, that this is a simple psychotic error, not an intentional act.
State Attorney George reminded Dr. Rosmarin that after the crash, Stephen had stolen the patrol vehicle and drove more than 100 miles per hour the wrong way on the interstate. She quipped, "That is not life-preserving," to which Dr. Rosmarin responded, "That is the reaction of a terrified, disorganized man." Dr. Rena Kapoor of the Yale School of Medicine also believed that Stephen was legally insane at the time of the crash. Dr. Kapoor was initially a prosecution witness, but turned into a defense witness. She said that at first she was skeptical of the insanity claims, but said that after interviewing Stephen and reviewing other material, she came to agree that he was legally insane. She stated, "In my opinion, he did have a mental disease at the time, and that because of that mental disease, he was both unstable and unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct and to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law." Dr. Kapoor diagnosed Stephen with a personality disorder with traits of borderline personality disorder and paranoid personality disorder. Carrie Crick of the Vermont State Police testified next. She told the jury that in the days leading up to the deadly crash, Stephen had received numerous phone calls from financial institutions and had called a bankruptcy lawyer who works exclusively with people who owe more than $10,000 in taxes. Just the day before the crash, Stephen had received at least 8 phone calls from creditors. Carrie Crick had also examined Stephen's phone. Stephen had told the psychiatrist that he had received a Facebook message out of the blue from an old friend called Chris Whitney. Stephen said to the psychiatrist that he hadn't spoken to Chris in years and that he believed that it was actually the government reaching out to him via Chris's Facebook. However, when the phone was examined, it turned out that it was Stephen who had initiated the conversation by telling Chris, "You have a lot of hot-looking friends. Were you really in the movies?" Furthermore, Stephen had told the psychiatrist that he had made a trip to Montpellier a day or two before the crash because he believed that he received messages from his phone telling him to go there. However, there was no evidence that Stephen was ever there. Contradicting the experts hired by the defense, Dr. Paul Cotton, a Burlington forensic psychiatrist, was next to testify. He stated that his opinion was that Stephen was not legally insane at the time of the crash and that he believed that Stephen knew his actions were wrong. He spoke about other things that Stephen had done in the run-up to the crash which showed no signs of mania, for example, going to work, carrying out tasks, and going for lunch with a friend. He diagnosed Stephen with adjustment disorder with disturbance of mood behaviour, a condition that arises from identifiable stressors. He stated, "I did not find data to support a mental disease. I use the disorder because of the fact it can describe, in my opinion, what he was experiencing and some of the stressors that led to his actions." Those stressors, he said, was the child custody dispute and financial problems. Two further psychiatrists who spoke to Stephen reached the same conclusion and found no evidence of mania, paranoia, or psychosis. While the defense contended that Stephen believed he was being spoken to by the government, Police Detective Sergeant Eric Jollymore said that when he examined Stephen's computer, he found no unusual Google searches and nothing relating to government conspiracies like one would expect. With all of the evidence presented, it was now time for closing arguments. Stephen had decided not to testify on his own behalf. Attorney Cadams once again reiterated his belief that Stephen was legally insane at the time of the crash. He stated, "Stephen Bourgoyne wasn't suicidal, he wasn't rageful, he was psychotic." State Attorney George refuted this, ending her argument with, "An accident did not kill these kids. Mr. Bourgoyne did." On the second day of deliberations, the jury reached a verdict.
So let me ask you a couple of questions. First, was the jury able to reach a verdict on all seven counts?
Yes.
And was the verdict unanimous on all seven counts?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Bourgoyne, if you would stand and face your jury. Mr. Burnett, the charge in docket 3814-16, count one, with respect to the second-degree murder, how did the jury find?
Found guilty.
Of second-degree murder.
Second-degree murder.
And that was unanimous?
It was.
They found Stephen Bourgoyne guilty of five counts of second-degree murder. After the verdict was read out, one by one, the parents of each victim held up a photograph of their child and gave statements to the media.
I'm relieved to put this part of this tragedy behind us so that I can move beyond focusing on my son Eli's death and go on to focus on his life and the beautiful person that he was.
We would ask you to refocus the energy towards the incredible young people whose lives were needlessly and tragically taken from us.
You have the ability to change someone's life through something as simple as a kind smile.
That was Mary. That's how she lived.
They said that they were glad that this part of the tragedy was over and done with, and now they could focus on commemorating the lives of their children. After the verdict, State Attorney George said that she was grateful for such a diligent and thoughtful jury and for the bravery of the loved ones who sat through the trial. She said, "I want the community to know that these were children. They were kids. They were high school students. They were 15 and 16 years old and had really incredible personalities, really big dreams, really impressive talents, and it was all taken away from them by one person." During the sentencing phase, the victim's family made impact statements to describe how Stephen's act had left a hole in their hearts that would never heal. Liz Harris, the mother of Mary, said that it had been 1,052 days since her daughter was killed. She said, "To quantify what you took from me that day, there really are no words." Mary's father, Daniel Harris, told Stephen that he must forgive him for what he did. He said, "Repent and atone and make an act of attribution and understand what grace is, because that will set you free." Eli's father, Bob Brookins, told Stephen that he should be ashamed of himself, while a video of Eli speaking about the love he had for his family and friends played on the screen. In another video, photographs depicted the life of Liam from when he was a baby up until his high school days as the song "Who You'd Be Today" played in the background. The victim impact statements were extremely poignant and emotional, and at several points, family members became so overcome with emotion that they needed to take a break. Before handing down the sentence, Judge Kevin Griffin described Stephen's crimes as horrific and said it was stunning that more people were not killed or seriously injured. He said, "Countless people have been victimized by Mr. Bourgoyne's actions." Stephen spoke briefly and apologized for his actions.
"I am so very sorry for my actions in which caused the accidents that October night."
It was the very first time that Stephen had publicly said anything about the crime. The judge sentenced Stephen Bourgoyne to 30 years to life in prison.
"My only hope for you is that you can reconcile what you've done and your actions, and that you can repent and atone and make an act of contrition and understand what grace is."
He was the most beautifully present person and the most accepting person.
"Stephen, we're going, I must forgive you."
Your teenage years are said to be some of the best years of your life. You start to get that little bit of freedom, but still, you don't have too many responsibilities. In a few years' time, you'll be going to college, getting a job, settling down, getting married, and even creating a family of your own. But in an instant, all of that can change. What started out as an enjoyable evening at a concert among lifelong friends turned into the epitome of every parent's nightmare. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said thanks at the start of the episode, but just another massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters. The support on there goes such a long way. If you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, early release episodes, ad-free episodes, polls, true crime articles, and a chance to pick a case for me to cover, then please check out Morbidology on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. Links are in the show notes. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Ratings are an easy way to support a podcast that you like, and I will be eternally grateful. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode, and stay tuned to the end to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, They Will Kill. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hello, the world. We are They Will Kill, a true crime podcast. I'm Courtney Eck.
And I'm Sadie Eck. And we are sisters that want to tell you about lesser known murders.
Our cases are always compelling, maybe even a little scary, with just enough banter to keep it interesting.
You can find us at theywillkill.com
or anywhere you listen to podcasts. See you there.
See ya.